What's his name? Yuri Greenberg or Greenberg, who was the famous Zionist poet. A lot of good stuff coming tonight. Before we do any of that, does anybody have any questions from their reading or anything that we've done so far? No? Anybody had a chance to do any of the reading? Anything stick out in any of that? Anybody? Warm you guys up. Come on. Anything stick out? Interesting? Not interesting? It's all interesting. It's true. It's true. It is all interesting. The Shapira book, you know, I reread it again, the pages, and I really enjoy it. She doesn't include everything, but I really like the way she weaves stuff together. It's a nice read. And I encourage you, after this course, or not before, whenever you want, to read her stuff from 48 onwards. It's a relatively new history. I think it came out in 2012, right? 10 or 12, something like that. So it's the latest and greatest, and it really has a lot. I mean, I have other books at home, and there are these really thick volumes laden in detail. But she tells you what you need to know. And it's a real pleasure.
I like the fact how she weaves in cultural things and economic things.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff going on, internal political
mm-hmm.
aspects to it.
And we're going to have a whole unit on cultural Zionism, the revolution of the Hebrew culture. And what that meant. We might get to a little bit of that tonight if we get to talk about the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. I put it at the end. If we don't get to it tonight, we're going to do it in a few weeks in the Hebrew Culture Unit. Because that really was the revolution of Zionism. It's not just that it created a state, but that it created a whole new culture. I mean, there is a and it's impacted international Jewry. There's a radically different approach to Jewish life today than there was 70, 80 years ago, or certainly 90, 100 years ago. There's a focus on the Jewish settlement in the land of Israel. That's where everything seems to come from. In many regards, Echad HaAm, his vision, came true, as did Herzl's at the same time. Echad HaAm, remember, he said it should be the center of the spoke wheel, and cultural Zionism was going to fan out. They were going to teach Hebrew and new ways to celebrate the land and the language and reinvigorate the concept of Jewish living and learning, and people are going to maybe visit there. And, you know, at that point he was saying only a minority of the Jews were going to live in the land of Israel. That's not the case anymore, by the way. I think about 2 years ago, the majority of Jews are now living in the state of Israel. Now, you can get into a whole bunch of issues in terms of who is a Jew and how you choose to count that. That's a whole other ballgame and not this course, but a majority of the Jews are living in the state of Israel right now. And as we spoke about a few weeks ago, when we were talking about, I think it was Klausner, he was saying that the diaspora was going to disappear. That eventually the diaspora was going to disappear. It wasn't authentic Judaism. It couldn't last. It didn't have any inherent value. And as many of us said, it seems that slowly that is indeed the case. And I countered and said, but who knows what can happen. Jewish history is filled with strange things that we didn't predict. All right? Do you want
to? I was going to say, that was Klatskin.
Klatskin, Joseph Klatskin. Yeah, there's a historian named Klausner as well, who was at the Hebrew University for many years, Joseph Klausner. Klatskin, thank you. All right, let's talk a little bit about, to refresher on the second Aliyah. It was from the years 1904 to 1914. 1904, that was just when the Japanese-Russian War began. It was when there was about to be a revolution in Russia. Remember, 1905, so that 1905 revolution pushed some people there, too. In 1914, of course, it stopped because of World War I. There was no more emigration across the rough seas at that point. We spoke a little, again, just a little bit of review and some new information as well. The folks that came over from this Aliyah, about 85,000 total came, but about 40,000 stayed. So about half of them left. That was the pattern in the early years. And that was really the pattern through the 1920s. It didn't become as much of a sin, and it really was seen as a sin, until the late 20s, early 30s in the Zionist movement to go to the land of Israel and then say, hey, I don't want to stay here. A lot of people went and went back to Europe and unfortunately met a horrible fate there, of course. All right, so these people were interesting in that none of them were living traditional lives, or very few of them were living traditional lives, unlike many in the first Aliyah. Remember the letter we read about the farm? They were talking about making challahs for Shabbat and getting ready and preparing. It was, you know, thank God this, thank God that the good Baron Rothschild is sending us money over here. These folks were from traditional backgrounds, but they were no longer traditional. But their families were. They grew up in the cheder, in the traditional Jewish schoolhouse. They were socialists and Marxists at this point. They grew up poor in small towns and villages. These are the ones, like David Ben-Gurion, who we're about to talk about, who came from the shtetls. Some were larger than others, some were smaller than others, but none of them were big city folks, as would be the case in the 1920s when people started coming in the third and fourth aliyahs, or aliyot. They were single-minded. Ben-Gurion is the classic example of this. They fixated on an idea and they wouldn't let go. This made them excel in politics. And by politics, I don't mean just with the state of Israel, I mean with the party politics that they had to deal with in the labor movement in Israel. And they would scream and yell at each other like no one could. They all wrote books about their experiences, or almost all of them wrote books about their experiences. We have a tremendous amount of literature. We were speaking a little before class about Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion was always writing. You would go into his office and he would be writing and still talk to you. And his office was filled with books. If any of you have been to... Anyone been to Ben-Gurion's house in Tel Aviv? So did you... Not Stay Boker. He went to Stay Boker in the later part of his life. But he had a home in Tel Aviv. If you ever have a chance, go into Beit Ben-Gurion, Ben-Gurion's house, and you see the library there. And it's got books in ancient Greek, which he read. It's got books in French, which he taught himself. And then when he started having meetings with the French, one of his things he was saying to them, "You'll have to excuse me, I've never spoken French before." Right? But he read it. And he wrote it. He just never spoke it. Remarkable figure. They all spoke Yiddish. Nearly all of them came knowing some Hebrew. Would not be the case in the 1920s. When we get to the 1920s, you have to think of what's happened. We've had a revolution already in Russia. We've had, you know, most of the people in the Second Aliyah came from 1904 to 1906, 1907. There was a little economic downturn, 1906, 1907. That always tempers Aliyah. And we saw that the third Aliyah ended because of that too, and it was 1924. They all came, almost all of them, again, I should qualify, as singles. They were young adults. They were idealistic. These were the people that were going to lead the Jewish state and its institutions over the next 50 years. Ben-Gurion himself was at the head of Jewish institutions from 1920 to 1963. He was always known as the old man because he seemed like he was almost always there. You have a picture, two pictures of him up there, by the way, which I just absolutely love. Guess which one is the young Ben-Gurion? So that's from about 1919, 1920. The other one is from 1970. He died in 73 at age 87. He had despite not having an easy life by any stretch of the imagination, he had a long and rich life in ways that mattered. We remember they created Histadrut, healthcare cooperatives, kibbutzim. We're going to talk about the moshavot, the moshavs tonight. These were the people that cemented the revival of the Hebrew language. Eliezer ben Yehuda came earlier, and we'll talk about him when we talk about the revival of Hebrew culture. And he came in 1881, actually, to the land of Israel. But these were the people that made it stick. These were the people that fought to make sure Hebrew was the language of instruction at schools and in Jewish meetings and throughout the yeshuv, the settlements. Because remember, a lot of schools were teaching in German and French, right? The ones funded by the Baron were being taught in French. The ones, the German Zionist Association was funding some schools as well. And we're going to see there's a major fight when the Technion comes around 1913, 1914 in Haifa as to whether or not the language should be in German or in French. Or in Hebrew. These were the ones also who created quality Hebrew newspapers and literature. You know, for them, again, they were absolutely fixated on this. They moved the locus of Hebrew literature from Eastern Europe to Israel. There was, until World War II, a vibrant Hebrew press in Europe. But it was eclipsed by the growing settlement and the writings coming from Israel itself. Interestingly enough, for Marxists and socialists, you might think, they were strong believers in democracy. They believed you had to have elections in your party. They believed you had to stand by the elections. There was no such thing as a coup. You know, what happened in the Soviet Union and many communist countries wasn't exactly the way that they say it's supposed to go. obviously. But these were what we call the social democrats, which we later saw in Germany and some other countries in Europe. They absolutely believed in socialism. They absolutely believed in democracy, particularly when it met their needs.
What about the Marxists? Do they really?
They, we're going to see, they temper themselves, actually. Most of the Marxists become socialists because they find that in the land of Israel, it just doesn't work as well as they would like. For example, Marxism has this whole category where you have to have a capitalist class and you have to overcome the capitalist class. There was no capitalist class. So there's a unique condition here. They literally sought to skip one phase of the Marxist revolution. As did the Soviets.
Be in Germany rather than Russia.
Right. And now the Soviets pretty much did that too. Right. There wasn't really a middle class. There was the upper class and there was everybody else. So they just felt that the ideology wasn't going to work there.
Is that called income inequality?
I'm not sure. I'm not an economist. Right. So define your term a little more.
I mean, back then, when what, the 1% had everything, 99% had nothing?
Yeah, it was probably 99.5%, particularly when you talk about Russia. Absolutely.
Nothing's
changed. Yeah, yeah.
And we can't have partisanship into this class. You
know, that's
right. In Russia? I'm talking about Russia.
Yeah, we're talking about Russia. That's right. We're going to keep it to Russia. All right, these guys did something very important as well. We're going to talk in detail about it tonight. They started the first Jewish defense organizations, groups that were meant to defend Jewish farms and communal settings. They focused on something called Avodah Ivri, or Hebrew work. We talked a little bit about this in some of the other classes. These guys said it's not the right thing to, you know, hire Arab laborers at half the price to harvest your crops if you have Jewish folks here that need jobs. Yeah, it's going to cost you a little more because there's a different standard of living, but the national good, which is a phrase they use a lot, the national consensus, is you should have Avodah Ivri, Hebrew workers. And by the way, it's interesting that they almost always use the word Ivri, Hebrew, and not Yehudi, Jewish, because they were creating a new Jew, all the way, in every single sense of the word, in every single sense that they could do. Remember, work was a central value to them, so they wanted as many people working as possible, and they were trying, always remember, to create a new Jew. A new Jew. And it said, by the way, there's a reason why they didn't choose the Ashkenazi pronunciation of Hebrew, because the Sephardi pronunciation wasn't what they knew. It was a little different. It was new. It was also, they believed, more authentic because the Eastern Jews spoke that, and those were the Jews that lived there. But it very well could have been that they spoke Ashkenazi Hebrew, but they made a conscious decision not to do that. All right, why did... Any questions until now? Okay. Why did they come? Many came because they were actually second-generation lovers of Zion. Hovei Tzion. Remember that organization? Echad HaAm started in that group as well back in the 1870s. Their fathers were active in Hovei Tzion for many of them. So they grew up with this concept of collecting money, going to meetings, but now, for this generation, it was time for action. They wanted to change the world, like many youth do, but they felt they couldn't change Russia. It wasn't theirs. Now, some Jews in Russia made a different choice. Some Jews became communists. Some Jews became kind of the socialist communists. Most Jews became Mensheviks when they were in that camp. Few of them became Bolsheviks. Right? They followed Trotsky in the Menshevik world. This was right after the Kishinev pogroms of 1903. The Kishinev pogroms, we've talked about this as well, shocked people so much. Remember, it shocked the British so much that they offered Herzl Eastern Uganda, which is Kenya, right? The Uganda program. The whole world was shocked by this. By our standards, it was a few dozen people who were killed or murdered. But by the standards of the day, it was quite horrible. We mentioned the Japanese-Russian War, the 1905 Revolution. Many were arrested and then freed and then decided to flee. And this was also, and this is a key thing to remember, this was amidst the mass emigration of Jews from Russia, from Eastern Europe. So a percentage, and a small percentage, would come to Palestine, Israel, the land of Israel, whatever you want to call it. Remember, 2 million came to this country from 1881 to roughly 1924. So we're going to say roughly 350,000, 400,000 came to Palestine in that same period. Actually, I shouldn't say that, from 1881 all the way up to 1939. Because in the 1930s, we certainly see 50,000 German Jews, for example, come over. Some Polish Jews keep coming over. Now I'm going to talk about David Ben-Gurion. Before I do that, a commercial for my friends with the guy who wrote this book. This is, I think, the best Ben-Gurion book around if you want to read more. It's called The Armed Prophet, and it's by a guy named Michael Bar-Zohar, and I'll leave it here and take a look at it during the break. This is a very old printing. This is from 68. But I urge you, if you read any additional book after this class, to read this one, because when you read about Ben-Gurion, you read about the Yishuv, and you read about the founding of the state, and you read about what we'll call the normalization of the state into the normal crazy antics of the mid-20th century. So it's a wonderful, wonderful book. All right. Ben-Gurion is Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln wrapped into one. Here we have a picture of him. He is known as the founding father of the state of Israel. I'm going to show you a couple more pictures before we start talking about him. Ben-Gurion was famous for taking up yoga in his 50s and 60s. So that's him on the Tel Aviv beach on the right. On the left, that's Ben-Gurion when in his Jewish Legion uniform in 1919. If you remember, Trumpeldor and Jabotinsky formed the first Jewish fighting force since Bar Kokhba was defeated in 135 CE. It was under the guise of the British Army. And I'll give you some details on his joining that. And he was a remarkable figure, and everybody has a Ben-Gurion story to tell if you knew Ben-Gurion. He rarely slept, it seems like. He always wrote, he always recorded, and he always pushed for more. He was relentless, he was remarkably focused. It's been said, I was talking to some people at the beginning of class, and he mentioned that he was one of the great statesmen or great political figures of 20th century history. And I think absolutely he's up there with Churchill, although Churchill obviously had a much larger stage. But Zionism in its own right is considered the greatest political ideology of the 20th century for what it was able to do. And Ben-Gurion was right thick in the middle of that for, you know, six decades of his life, actually. All right. Let me give you some biographical information. He was born in 1886. He died in 1973. He was born in Plonsk, P-L-O-N-S-K, Poland. He writes, and I'm going to read this from here because I don't think you can see it that well. He writes that there... Actually, this is a different figure. Actually, can we make this a little larger?
Yeah.
Well, here, I can do it right here. I apologize. Hold on a second. There we go. Can we almost read that? Okay. All right. So we're going to get that to a moment. He writes, by the way, that he didn't particularly feel anti-Semitism growing up. I've read these passages from his diaries, and he talks about how his town was really divided into three groups. There were Jews, there were Poles, and there were Russians. And the Poles and the Russians lived kind of scattered on the periphery all around, and the Jews were concentrated in one area toward the center. So the Jewish kids would always roam around, and they would be the ones to beat up the Poles and the Russians, which is unusual. But, you know, they could whistle, and 20 more guys would come running out of their houses, or, you know, hey, there's a commotion, let's come help us out there. But he felt that they got along well. It wasn't that he was escaping Poland's anti-Semitism. It was that he believed that there was only one place where he needed to be. And unlike many of the figures in the Zionist history, he didn't, as a young adult, spend time in Warsaw like Greenberg did, the poet, or he wasn't in Berlin like Weizmann getting a degree. He just went to Palestine at the age of 19. And that was that. At age 14, he and two of his friends formed a youth club called Ezra, E-Z-R-A. The beliefs were study Hebrew and emigrate to Palestine. That was it. Those are the two things that they did. You know, when I was 14 years old, I was playing baseball, I was flipping baseball cards and what have you. These guys were talking about changing the world. 1905, he was a student at the University of Warsaw. He joined Pro Lezion, which we spoke about last week. Remember, does anybody remember if they were Marxist or socialist? Pro Lezion? All right, they started Marxist,
and then they modified.
They were the ones that Ber Borukhov wrote the ideology for, originally with the Marxism. After he died in 1919, they moderated some. He was arrested twice during the 1905 revolution. Right? He just, guess he looked suspicious, so they arrested him. He was a young man. 1906, he decided, you know, enough is enough, it's time to go to Palestine. So he went off to Palestine. 2 weeks after he arrived, he stunned people by giving a full address in Hebrew to a group of workers. He had, was all ready for this. 1 month after he had arrived, he was elected to the Central Committee of the Jaffa Pro Lezion group. So, 1906, 1 month later, Ben-Gurion's already involved in a leadership position. 1907, he spent the year picking oranges at Petah Tikva. And my relatives live in Petah Tikva, so I just try and imagine it as an orange field today. Orange groves today. It's remarkable. 1909, he volunteered with Hashomer, which we'll hear about in a little bit. That means the guard or the guardian. That was a Jewish defense group. They were protecting agricultural communities. In 1912, he decided, you know, if we're going to live with the Turks, and who knows how long we're going to have to live with the Turks, we're going to have to know the Turks. So I'm going to go to Istanbul and go to law school so I can really help my community, and I'm going to learn Turkish while I'm there, too. He did that. He didn't last too long because war was going to break out. When war did break out, he came back to Palestine, and at first, he advocated loyalty to the Turks. He said, look, if we're on the wrong side on this, and they win, we've got a big problem. If we're on the wrong side and they lose, you know, we're still Russian citizens, we're German citizens, we're whatever citizens we happen to be. Right? Germans would be allied with the Turks, obviously. He wanted to serve in their army, but they wouldn't let him. That's how serious he was about it. Now, of course, as always is the case, he wanted to serve in their army to gain military experience because he thought that was going to be necessary. 1915, he was one of hundreds of people who were deported by the Turks because he had Russian citizenship. And the Russians were fighting against the Turks and against the Germans. So he went in exile to the United States. He went with his good friend Yitzhak Ben Zvi, who was going to be with him through the rest of his life in terms of doing things and succeeding. He stayed in the United States for 3 years. While there, he met Paula. Hello.
I need to get my stuff.
Sure. No problem. Excuse me. He met a woman named Paula and married her. He only had one condition, which was, we're moving to Palestine. I'm going back to Palestine. I'm not staying here in the United States. I'm not getting trapped here. And while he was there in the United States, here in the United States, he circulated around the country. He raised money for Jewish organizations. He raised attention for Zionist groups. He continued to wave the flag as strongly as he could. 1918, he made his way back to Egypt. Egypt was controlled by whom?
British.
The British. Egypt was controlled by the British. He joined the Jewish Legion, which was the group that was formed in 1918 by the British. Remember, we talked about that and their role in Gallipoli. And then eventually they came up after the conquest of Palestine. They were able, after the main conquest of Palestine, they were able to take part in the battles of the Galilee and the Jordan Valley. 1919, war's over now, obviously. As I mentioned, Ber Borukhov dies, the great ideologue, the Marxist. Pro Lezion splits into, you gotta love Israeli politics, Pro Lezion right and Pro Lezion left. That's literally what they were called. Confusing as it might be, Pro Lezion left was not left in the way that you might think. They were the socialists. Right were the conservators of the Marxist ideology. So the right one, the Marxists, was a little bit smaller. However, the ones on the left would eventually eclipse them as well. There is a history of a Marxist group in Israel and Israeli politics. I think Chadash was the name of the party. They're not around anymore, but They're Marxists and they're split between half Arabs and half Jews. That's always how they do their Knesset seating. 1920, next year, he becomes head of the new Histadrut Zionist Labor Federation. This is how he's really going to recreate the world. This is how he's going to change everything, by Zionist labor, Jewish labor. Moving ahead a little bit, up to 1930, he's the guy that engineers the final consolidation of all the workers' parties. Remember in 1920, we talked about Ahdut Avodah, but not everybody joined Ahdut Avodah. Most did, but not everybody. By 1930, he was able to get everybody joined, and it was a new version of Ahdut Avodah, which means the unity of labor. And this actually was the Mapai Party, M-A-P-A-I. The Mapai Party is the labor party, as we know it in Israeli politics today. It stands for Mifleget Poalei Yisrael, which is the Israel Workers' Party. By 1935, he becomes chairman of the Jewish Agency Executive, so a position he holds until 1948. That's the moment, by the way, that he really bumps Weizmann off the stage. Weizmann still holds a lot of power, but the locus is now in the land of Israel. The Zionist movement has, in Israel, has overtaken World Zionist politics and the World Zionist Congress. 1942, it's again, just a couple highlights from his career. Something called the Biltmore Conference, we'll talk about that when we get to American Zionism. It was held at the Biltmore Hotel in New York City. That's when Ben-Gurion is the one who, for the first time, declares that our goal is a Jewish state. Remember, until now, they have only been declaring that they want a British protectorate. And that's Weizmann's influence, too. But at this point, with the war going on and news of the Holocaust beginning to come out in 42, he says, no, we can only have a Jewish state. And in 1948, on May 14th, just before Shabbat starts, he famously declares the new state of Israel. And if any of you have ever seen the recording, or haven't seen the recording, I urge you to go on YouTube and type in Israel Independence 1948, and you see the crowds dancing in the street and the people cheering. And Ben-Gurion did not celebrate that night. He said, I know war's coming, which it came later that day. And he had been told a week earlier that the state had a 50% chance of survival because of the odds that were against it by Yitzhak Sadeh, who was one of the famous Haganah commanders. All right. Any questions? All right. We know he's known as the old man. By the 1930s, he's already spent 25 to 30 years in Zionist leadership. Right, and he's going to stay on stage. He's not going to resign from Knesset until 1970, at the age of 84. This is a guy who's got some stamina, to say the least. I think maybe only outdone by his protege, Shimon Peres, who is 90 years old, and I saw a picture of him today in the newspaper meeting the president of some other country. Truly, truly remarkable figure. But that's next year's course. By the way, Peres gets active under Ben-Gurion's wing in the early 1940s, or mid-1940s, really. All right, by 1963, he had spent 43 years atop the Zionist establishment. He's, of course, famous for that shock white hair and that those, what do they call them, tussles on the side? I don't know what it is. Tufts, that's it. Tufts. Tufts of hair. As you saw in the pictures, he wasn't always like that. He was an impatient man, doesn't surprise you, to say the least. He was truculent to both political friends and foes. He had his way, and that was it. He very much believed he was right. But he also had a remarkable ability to grow. He was a much stronger leader in the 1950s than he had been in the 1930s. You know, many of the people of this generation were like that. They really were able to rise to the occasion. And, of course, the challenges were of such magnitude that we wouldn't have heard of them had they not survived, been able to rise to the occasion in these times. Another example, he outgrew his Marxist origins. He was Marxist in the Pole Tzion. He was an ardent follower of Ber Borokhov. And then he said, but it doesn't work here. You know, ideology is great. We need to build houses. We need to work with the capitalists who own the stores in the cities because we need their income to help fund the farms. He remained a socialist, however, to the end. He saw the state as the best vehicle for changing the Jew. There was a method to the madness. For him, economic power and defense was key. It was absolutely key. He was known as a real hawk. There was a wing of the Labor Party known as the Labor Hawks, and he was the head of it. He said you have to have a Jewish economy. You can't have one dependent on the Arabs. He said it's not going to work. Something's going to go horribly awry if we do that. Yet he still, with all that reality, he still saw himself as a revolutionary. And I'm going to read the quote that you have up there. And Zionism is a revolution, because I think this beautifully captures his ideology. This is From Class to a Nation is a collection of his speeches. Zionism is, in its essence, is a revolutionary movement. Pretty basic there. One could hardly find a revolution that goes deeper than what Zionism wants to do in the life of the Hebrew people, Am HaIvri, not Am HaYehudi. This is not merely a revolution of the political and economic structure, but a revolution of the foundations of the personal lives of the members of the people. The very essence of Zionist thinking about the life of the Jewish people and on Hebrew history is basically revolutionary. It is a revolt against a tradition of many centuries. He's not going for the religious Zionism. Helplessly longing for realization, an attempt at reconstruction. Oh, I just passed something. Hopelessly longing for redemption. Instead of these sterile and bloodless longings, we substitute a will for realization, an attempt at reconstruction and creativity on the soil of the homeland. Instead of a people dependent on others, instead of a minority living at the mercy of a majority, we call for a self-sufficient people, master of its own fate. Instead of a corrupt existence of middlemen, hung up in the midair, we call for an independent existence of working people, at home, on the soil, and in a creative economy. And that's Ben-Gurion. I think that beautifully captures everything that you need to know about Ben-Gurion. So, now we come to the question. We know he believed in a Jewish state. We know he believed in Hebrew work. What did he really believe in? He believed the Jewish working class was a carrier of revolutionary goals. That's why he loved the working class, because they were the ones who were going to change the world. The capitalists, let's face it, they want to grow their business. They're not going to change the world. He said Jews must defend themselves. They can't trust anyone else. That's come true. The goal is to bring as many people to Israel as soon as possible, because tragedy is going to come eventually to Europe. We already know that there have been many tragedies. And he said that we're going to do this legally or illegally. And indeed, he signs off on the illegal immigration during World War II, called the Aliyah Bet, or the Second Aliyah, where they're bringing people in illegally. He instructs the Haganah to do that. And thousands come in that way. He also has a disdain and no sense of patience for diaspora politics. He's not interested. Been there, done that. The Jewish people don't need that. It's a bunch of hot air, people, you know, basically yelling at each other. Although, he eventually winds up becoming chair of the Jewish Agency, but he wants to move that all over to Israel. He feels that that's what he has to do to control the purse strings and control the foreign relations of the Jewish people, so to speak. His mantra was Jewish unity when it fit his needs. Right, he wasn't always the nicest guy. We talked about him being behind the unity of the labor parties. He feuded constantly with right-wing revisionists under Jabotinsky. We're gonna have a whole thing on Jabotinsky in your Stanislavski book. About half that book is about Jabotinsky. In the 1920s, he condoned violence to break the strikes of the right-wing Zionists. They would go out and protest against labor's hold on everything. In the 1930s, he actually went back on that and negotiated truce with Jabotinsky. So again, the realist comes into play here. Things are different here. And yet in 1948, in one of the saddest chapters of Zionist history, during a ceasefire in the war, the first ceasefire, there were two ceasefires, he fired on a ship called the Altalina, which was off the ship of Tel Aviv, which was bringing in weapons for the Irgun, which was... Now Jabotinsky's been dead 8 years. He died in 1940. That's Menachem Begin was one of the people on that ship, jumped off that ship. He would never speak to Begin, by the way. He hated Begin so much. And Begin was the leader of the opposition. So he fired on that ship because it would have broken the truce in his mind. And he killed some members of the Irgun. Let's take a moment and talk about his views on Arabs. He, like many of the Zionist leaders of his era, unlike many of the Zionist leaders who were in the diaspora initially, focused on how are we going to deal with the fact that there is an overwhelming number of Arabs in this country. right? It's not a minor question. We want this to be the Jewish homeland, and we want to have a national Jewish home, as the Balfour Declaration says, from 1917. But how can we do that if there's 500,000 Arabs and 80,000 Jews? What are we going to do about that? He actually had numerous conversations with Arab leaders. There's a book called My Conversations with Arab Leaders by David Ben-Gurion. I couldn't find it. I thought I had it, or I had it at one point. It's a very interesting book. Remember, this has not been unprecedented. Remember, Weizmann had the conversations with Faisal and struck up the Faisal-Weizmann Pact as well, the Weizmann-Faisal Pact. He tried to learn Arabic, but gave it up. For whatever reason, Arabic was too much for him. Like I said, interestingly, he learned Turkish. He was fluent in who knows what. Let's see, Turkish, English, Hebrew, Polish, Yiddish, French. I'm guessing he did some German, you know, because he did Yiddish, right? Yiddish is 80% German, so he certainly could understand German. So, you know, if I presented him to you in that regard in his leadership positions, you would say, wow, what a polished statesman. Ben-Gurion was anything but polished. Anything but polished. He did the job that he felt needed to get done. He had mixed views on Arabs. Let's see if we have some of these. I love that thing when standing on his head. There we go. All right, so, actually I have some different quotes. Well, I'll read these quotes. All right, everybody sees the problem in the relations between the Jews and the Palestinian Arabs, but not everybody sees that there's no solution to it. There is no solution. The conflict between the interests of the Jews and the interests of the Palestinian Arabs in Palestine cannot be resolved by sophisms. I don't know any Arab who would agree to Palestine being ours, even if we learn Arabic. And I have no need to learn Arabic. He was wrong there, by the way. On the other hand, I don't see why Mustafa should learn Hebrew. There's a national question here. We want the country to be ours. The Arabs want the country to be theirs. That's early on. He's a little less polished than he is even normally. He's pretty truculent, pretty straightforward in his sayings there. You know, finally, he's going to go on to say to the United Nations on October 2nd, 1947, this is just before they decide on partition, which will come in November, this is our native land. It's not as birds of passage that we return to it, but is situated in an area engulfed by Arabic-speaking people, mainly followers of Islam. Now, if ever, we must do more than make peace with them. We must achieve collaboration and alliance on equal terms. But then, remember what Arab delegations from Palestine and its neighbors say in the General Assembly and in other places. Talk of Arab-Jewish amity sounds fantastic, for the Arabs do not wish it. They will not sit at the same table with us. They want to treat us as they do Jews of Baghdad, Cairo, and Damascus. So at least he's not ignoring the reality. And it's a very harsh reality, and I would submit that he's doing it in the right way here. He's saying, we have a tie to this land. We know these people don't want us here. This is the problem. What are you going to do about it? And what does the United Nations eventually do? They split the land in much more generous ways than the Peel Commission did in 1937. The 1947 partition, voted on 47, enacted on May 15, 1948, was actually the second attempt at partitioning the lands. The British tried to do it with the Peel Commission in 37, and that was much, much smaller. So he's evolved, in some regards, into a practical leader. He hasn't forgotten who he is and what he is, but he's able to take a situation and evaluate it for what it is. In 1936 to 1939, for example, there was something called the Arab Uprising. The Arab Uprising was a revolt against the British as well as the Jews by the Arabs. They basically said, we're never going to get what we want, so we're going to resort to violence. Ben-Gurion said, we're going to cooperate with the British, but we're also, with the Arabs, going to have something called a policy of havlaga, or restraint. He says, we're not going to get involved in these reprisal raids, although there were some. We're not going to get involved in a bloodbath because we don't want to alienate the British and we don't want to escalate the situation because we're about 450,000 now in 1936. We're going to be 650,000 by 1948. but we still don't want this to get out of hand. So he's well remembered for that. He's also famous, just to wrap up on Ben-Gurion, for the 1939 White Paper. The British had a policy of issuing white papers, which was a declaration of their intentions and the result of a formal commission. And they had 7 white papers from 1921 to 1939. Well, the 1939 one was the white paper which said, or the British, we're going to war. We know that the Jews are stuck in a bad place, right? The Jews are not going to ally with Nazi Germany. They're going to be loyal to us, wherever they are. They're going to be loyal to the Allies. We need the Arabs. We need them to stay on our side, or we're going to have a big problem, because, you know, we control Iraq, we control Jordan, we control Egypt. Well, they're kind of out of Egypt, but not entirely. We control Palestine. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to limit immigration from the Jews to 15,000 a year for 5 years. 75,000. And that's it. We're not going to have any more immigration after that. And then we're going to have a constituent assembly, which is something they continually try to do, which is we're going to have a representative assembly. So if the Jews are 30% of the community in Palestine, they're going to get 30% of the seats. And that gives the Arabs an overwhelming majority. Now, the Arabs continually rejected that when it was proposed, because to accept it would mean to accept the fact that the Jews would have some political power. And they felt that eventually the Jews would take over the political power. But nonetheless, Ben-Gurion came out and said to his people, who said, we're not going to ally with the Nazis, but how can we cooperate with the British? They're cutting off immigration at a time when we need it more than ever. This is not about Zionism anymore. This is about saving people's lives. Ben-Gurion said famously, we will fight the white paper as if there were no war, and we will fight the war as if there were no white paper. And he's well known for that, and that's exactly what he did. He instructed the Haganah to get involved in illegal immigration, and I think, I can't remember the exact number, but tens of thousands of young Jewish men volunteered for the British Army in World War II, including a guy who was over in England, by the way, named Abba Eben. I don't think Eben was his last name. It was Aubrey, I know that for sure. I'd have to check on that. And I think it was, because Aubrey's the name that changed. All right, anyway, we are a few minutes shy of 8 o'clock, but rather than start a new unit, I'm going to take a break now. Are there any questions?
What was the view of the people of the Second Aliyah towards the religious aspect?
Right.
Where they saw the future, you mean the
religious Jews who were in Israel?
No, the religious Jews in Israel, or religious Jews in the diaspora who might come to Israel.
Well, these guys felt religion had had its day, and they weren't interested
so
in it anymore.
They weren't anti-religion, basically.
They weren't actively anti-religion.
Yeah, no, I understand what they're doing.
Yeah, because remember their backgrounds and their families. And they were more comfortable talking to religious leaders because they could talk to them in Yiddish than the later immigrants were, which is interesting. Even by the 1920s, Yiddish wasn't a first language for many people. If you were born in, Ben-Gurion was born in 1886, right? So he spoke Yiddish. But if you were born in 1905 and came over in 1925, you might not speak Yiddish anymore.
They were more passive than you might say.
Passive and
they weren't really contesting for political power, for control of the issue. They were more internal.
Oh, the Orthodox.
The Orthodox.
Right. But keep in mind, they thought that all these young upstarts were sinners, right? Because they were trying to create a political reality that God didn't allow to have to take place yet. They felt that they were violating God's law.
Right. So the friction didn't come until later in terms of buying for.
Right, but what's going to happen in the British era, and you know, I know, keep saying it sounds like we're going to have a million more lectures, but when we get to the religious lecture, what we're going to see is that the ultra-Orthodox, the Haredim or Agudat Yisrael, form their own group, their own council, and we're going to talk about that very briefly tonight, to have a liaison with the British that's separate from the Yishuv, the organized Jewish community. They wanted to be separate in every way. Although, to give the Yeshuv credit, they went and saved those folks in 48, particularly in the old city of Jerusalem. You know, and when the riots in Hebron came in 1929, they wanted to send some Haganah volunteers down there to save them, but they said no. So, all right, well, let's take... Oh, yeah, one more.
I just have a comment.
Yeah, please.
The two were Hebrew and the Hebrews and Jews.
Yeah.
I think the word Hebrew is a little more inclusive than Jews. Jews, the tribe of Judah. Hebrew, the Hebrew, it's a Hebrew nation. Jews were not... Judah was a tribe.
Right, absolutely, Yehuda. Shevet Yehuda, absolutely.
And I think that may be one reason why Hebrew sounds more inclusive, but Jews sticks, because that's a term, a word that's used used down through history, in more current history.
Yeah.
They still say Jewish state, but he wanted to be known as a Hebrew, really a Hebrew country, a Hebrew nation.
Very good.
That's a comment.
Fair enough. All welcome. Thank you. All right, guys. We'll find a water fountain. Yeah, we kind of refreshed that, which really laid the stage for David Ben-Gurion, who was just this remarkable, remarkable focus figure. And we spent so much time on him because he's such a huge factor in Zionist history. From 1906, you know, again, 2 weeks after he gets off the boat, till 1970, when, you know, he kept getting elected to Knesset even after he left the Labor Party in 63. You know, the last elections in 69, he got elected to Knesset because the name Ben-Gurion. That's it. You know, he won 4 seats, his party. I can't remember what his party was called at that time. Yep.
Just back up a little bit. Ben-Gurion said that the Jews and the Arabs could never really occupy the same land at the same time.
Right.
Did he have a therefore what?
Not that I recall. He wasn't focused in that regard. And what he was saying was, it's us or them, and you know whose side I'm on, and this is a struggle. This is a struggle to the death. He wasn't a that was 1919. That was on the eve of the Versailles Conference. He wasn't a statesman yet. He was still a revolutionary at that point.
Did he ever change his mind?
He didn't have to change his mind, because all of a sudden he inherited a state that had a majority Jewish population in it. And that's what he wanted. His goal after 1948-49 was defense. You know, protect the land of Israel, protect the state of Israel.
He just wanted a Jewish state that was predominantly Jewish.
Yeah, absolutely. Overwhelmingly Jewish.
It was a balance, right? They had to say there could be coexistence, but they had to fight against binationalism. So they had to say they have to be
separate but equal. And he was fighting, Jews on binationalism. There was something called the Ichud, the unity movement, which Martin Buber and Judah Magnus and all the intellectuals of the country favored. So there was a big push for a binational state. Ben-Gurion fought that very hard, very, very hard. He didn't want the workers with their socialist equality views to be captivated by that, because that would have been a big problem. Yeah.
I'm just saying, we're in January of 2014, and I hear the same words.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we have many, many statesmen out there, too.
Well, look, but today, the truth of the matter is, the debates in Israel are about the Jews. The country is 80% Jewish, roughly, 20% Arab. There's not much focus on the quality of life for Arab Israelis. No. You don't hear about that.
No, for good reason,
perhaps. You didn't hear it 40 years ago, either, 50 years ago.
Well, the Arabs, until I think it was 64 or 65, were under military curfew in Israel.
But I worked with people who said, in Hebrew University, they would be in laboratory courses. The Jews got the front seats. Mm-hmm. The Jews got all the laboratory positions. And if there was room left over, mm-hmm. then the Arabs could get whatever equipment was left over.
Right.
Which in a scientific program is done.
Absolutely. All right. So I think, you know, it's an interesting thing, just to sum up what we're saying, particularly what you were saying, is that those problems are still with us. They haven't been resolved. And the truth is, maybe those problems will never be resolved. It's about managing the conflict on all levels. That's really the issue in the situation. You know, there's no solution to certain problems. You know, in life, we know that. It's how you deal with it. All right. Moving on. Now we're coming to the third Aliyah. Aliyah is known for being in waves. There were five Aliyot in particular. Sometimes people say there's six Aliyahs. Those were the survivors from the death camps that came from the DP camps after World War II and when the gates of Israel were opened. All right, this is from 1919 to 1923. Again, it stops with the economic depression in Palestine. After that, by the way, is going to come a couple years later, a fourth Aliyah, which is primarily the Polish middle class. Remember, Poland is the breadbasket. This is where the vast majority, or the largest concentration of Jews in any one country is in Poland. There's anywhere from 3 million to 3.5 million Jews there in 1939, when World War II started. One ship back to the third Aliyah in 1919 called the Ruslan, R-U-S-L-A-N. That took on the image of the Mayflower. It came over in 1919, had 650 new immigrants on it, many intellectuals, poets, artists, young people who really said, you know, we're going off here to make a new country and a new life. These two, just like in the second Aliyah, were mainly young adults. There were some families that came over, some married people, some people with children. Those were primarily people who would go into business. They would gravitate toward the cities. The city, when I say the cities, we're really talking about three cities. We're talking about Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and Haifa. What we know is Petach Tikva and Rishon LeZion and places like this, these aren't cities yet. They're starting to become communities, and they're surrounded by farms, but they're not cities, certainly not in the sense we think of them today. A lot of these folks knew very little Hebrew when they got to Israel. They certainly knew little or no Yiddish. Their first language was often Russian or Polish. This Aliyah was triggered by the October Revolution in the now Soviet Union. Remember, we're already talking about 1919. And really, by the early 20s, the Russian Civil War is about over. It'll go on for a year or two after that. There's a new round of anti-Semitic pogroms taking place in Eastern Europe. In the Ukraine alone, in what are known as the Petilura pogroms, there's estimates of 100,000 to 200,000 Jews are killed. You know, what happens is the two sides fight each other, the revolutionaries and the people in control, and the Jews get caught in the middle. And we've seen that since the Napoleonic Wars, which we talked about way back when in Europe. Nationalism is being uncorked with the revolutions. We've talked about nationalism a lot in this class. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburg Empire, falls apart with the end of World War I. There's a lot of ethnic minorities in there. We've got the Czechs, we've got the Slovaks, we've got everybody in what's going to become Yugoslavia and what have you. There's a lot of fighting going on until borders are solidified. And immigration to the United States is almost closed. By 1924 and 25, it'll close off fully, but there's restrictive measures being put in place. So if you want to get out, you've got a couple choices. You can get into England if you can get into England, and you can go to Palestine, which certainly helps. But the massive immigration is at an end at this time. And not everybody wants to go to Palestine. However, it's more attractive than it has been in the past. The British are beginning to stabilize the country. There are roads, there are buildings, there is electricity, there is water getting to other parts of the country. Tel Aviv, which we're going to talk about very soon, was a real city by now. The Byzantine bureaucracy of the Turks is gone. You don't have to pay bribes. You don't bribe the British, right? You might not agree with them, but that's not proper. And if the British are anything, they're proper. All right. Some of these folks, by the way, were members of a group that we haven't mentioned yet that I just want to mention briefly because you might have heard of them. It's called Hashomer Hatzair. Has anybody ever heard of that? Okay, it's one of the left-wing groups that's out there. It literally means guardians of the youth. Hashomer Hatzair.
They wear the blue shirts with the
kerchief?
Crisscross ties.
Yeah. My daughter was in that group.
Yeah, there are various incarnations over the years. They're not a political party, they're a youth movement, although they will have a political party in the 1940s for just a few years. It's the oldest Zionist movement still in existence today. That is, of course, because some of the ones in Europe were totally wiped out, like Gordonia, which we spoke about, named for A.D. Gordon. It was formed in 1913 in Galicia, which is really one of the Jewish breadbaskets. they had a number of summer camps. We talked about Camp Moshavah. All these things, they're wrapped together in some fashion. Good kibbutz training ground. They were known for their idealism, their dances, their conversations or sichot, their way of creative interpretation of Jewish holidays. They were pacifist. They believed in the binational state, which we spoke about a few moments ago. They were originally Marxist. Now they're just socialists, just socialists. They set up kibbutzim. These are the ones that had the children's houses. The parents don't raise the children. They live in the children's houses. You know, if you're lucky, you get to visit your children once a week on Friday night or something like that. Their goal, quote, was to liquidate the family as a social unit, recognizing it only as an expression of erotic life. In other words, you have family to create children, and that's it. You know, that's, you know, to continue. All right. And we've talked about the kibbutz. I want to briefly mention also that I have a lot of material to cover tonight. That's why I'm doing this in brief, as opposed to other nights. We want to talk about the moshav. Anybody know what a moshav is and how it differs from a kibbutz?
It's more like a little farm, isn't it?
So it's a lot of little farms together.
Privately owned.
Collective. It's a collective. And the first kibbutz, Nachalal, which is where Moshe Dayan's family settled, he was, I believe, the second person born there. They have houses that are together, or sometimes in a half circle or circle. On the other side is the communal property, which would be the shed and maybe the little store and, you know, where you keep the livestock. They had farms in back of their houses branching out. They own those farms individually. However, they would go in together on marketing the produce. And they would split up the proceeds of that. So it was a way to have a little bit more privacy than you would on the kibbutz. And in fact, Nachalal, which was founded in 1921 in the Lower Galilee, was founded by people who were originally on Degania Aleph. Degania Aleph, we remember, was the first kibbutz. They felt smothered there, and there was another reason, too. The original kibbutzim weren't meant to have a lot of people. They were meant to have 90, 100, 110 people. When it started getting too big, some people left and they went to found another kibbutz or another type of settlement. Yeah?
I just want to mention, when you're speaking about Nachalal, that Meir Shalev is a famous Israeli contemporary author. His family is from Nachalal, going back to the Stephen Eliyahu. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called My Russian Grandmother and Her American Vacuum, and it's a memoir of his family. And brief but very interesting, and gives a lot of really good history about the settling of that land.
Yeah, that sounds great. And was he speaking here, or did he speak here?
I think he may have spoken here. He, when the book came out a couple of years ago, he toured around. I don't know if he was ever in Baltimore, but we read it for the Ashkelon Partnership Book Club last year, and it just was really interesting. If you want,
neat. And what's it called again?
My Russian Grandmother and Her American
Vacuum.
The vacuum is the central character of this.
And it's rare that a vacuum is the central character of a book.
True, it's really
all the places it's clean.
Exactly, most clean houses.
It had its own room in the house.
That's great.
To enter, yeah.
That's great.
A place of honor.
All right. All right, now let's talk about some defense units. Hashomer, H-A-S-H-O-M-E-R, which means the guard or the guardian. And some of you may know, for example, when somebody has passed away, somebody who watches the body all night is the shomer, or the two people who watch it are the shomrim.
Stand outside the yichud room after a wedding.
Right, stand outside the room the couple's in after the wedding. Yeah, shomer is a common word. This was the first attempt to provide organized defense for the farms and collective farms of the Yishuv. It meant to supplant the Arab guardians. Remember, the problem with hiring the Arabs was they would either steal from you or other Arabs would steal from you to embarrass them. Right? So it wasn't dependable. There was never more than 100 of these folks. I don't want to mislead you. It wasn't a big unit. They had to borrow money to buy guns. But this was the first, and this came about in 1910. Let's give you a good picture. All right, there's one. They dressed as locals, as you can see. That's a guy named Mendel Portugali. They dress as, you know, the Bedouins or the Druze. They got horses to patrol on. They even set up a primitive production center for bullets, which is something that the Haganah would master. And they actually charged a fee for their protection. And their goal, however, was to provide protection for every Jewish farm in the country. They had rules of engagement. This wasn't just, you know, they sat up all night one night and they came up with this stuff. You do not seek an encounter with a thief. You chase him off. Only when you have no choice do you shoot. After all, he is out to steal a bag of grain, not to murder you. So don't murder him. Drive him off. Don't sleep at night. If you hear footsteps, fire into the distance. If you feel he is a few footsteps away and you can fire without him falling upon you, fire into the distance. Only if your life is in danger, fire. What you're seeing here and what I want you to take notice of is the effort at discipline in the yeshuv. All these institutions are meant to provide a common goal, not to detract from statehood, to do things that are necessary, but there's a real effort here to keep it together and not let things get out of hand. And let me show you one more picture, which is a lovely photo. There you go. There's some Hashomer members in 1915. Some good Jewish boys out on a ride for a Sunday afternoon. It looks like Pimlico.
how do they differentiate between themselves and the Arabs if they're wearing the keffiyehs?
I guess they know who you are, you know? Yeah. Right, yeah. That's right. They're not the one saying Allah Akbar. All right. They're primarily Ashkenazi, but there are some Sephardi. The Sephardim are going to begin to really make their note, by the way, in the 1930s when there's an intelligence unit set up in the Haganah, and they have Sephardim who are Arabic-speaking. So that's when they're going to start to rise. And they're cooperating with the British during the Arab Revolt as well. There were concerns raised by the older settlers, by the way, the ones who came in the 1880s and 90s and just before the Second Aliyah. They were afraid the Arabs would be angry because they were losing their jobs. They were afraid of retaliatory raids. They thought things would get out of hand. And they also just generally worried about the status quo being upset. Look, we've learned to live with the Arabs. It's okay. We don't need you young upstarts coming in here. The young upstarts saw it a little differently. Hashomer was superseded, of course, by Haganah. Haganah is a H-A-G-A-N-N-A-H, and that means defense, or Ha-Haganah, the defense. It was founded in 1920. It was founded because Arab gangs were attacking Jews on the farms, kibbutzim, and moshavot. Things were getting out of hand. There were various spikes in violence during the mandate period. When we say the mandate period, by the way, we really mean 1920 on. And there were some riots in 1920, and then in 21, and then in 29, and then 36 to 39. Excuse me. The Haganah was also set up because the leadership of the yeshuv, which Ben-Gurion was now a part of, head of Histadrut, which was an important position to be in, they simply didn't trust the British to protect them fully. They said, they're not going to protect us fully. They don't understand what's going on here. And they were right. So the Shomrim merged into the Haganah. This became really the pre-state militia. It didn't ratchet it up until the late 1930s. In the 1940s, by the way, they set up the Palmach, which was the elite strike force, or the commando unit, and the Haganah really became the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces. 1926, for example, there were three main chapters, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and Haifa. There are only 350 members, but this is 250 more than Shomer had. They had 750 rifles, 750 hand grenades, 1,000 pistols, and 27 machine guns, and they used small boys as messengers to run back and forth for them. So this wasn't an extremely sophisticated operation, but it was the beginning of something very, very important. After the 1929 riots, and that's the Hebron riots that we hear about, which also took place in Jerusalem and Haifa and Jaffa and a little bit in Tel Aviv, the Haganah gets much larger. The leadership in the yeshuv decides defense needs to be a bigger part of what we do. In fact, if you lived on a collective settlement, a farm, a kibbutz, a moshav, you were expected, and you were a youth, you were expected to be a part of the Haganah. In some way, you were in training for the Haganah, and all the young men were members of the Haganah. And indeed, there were secret training on the various kibbutzim throughout those years, and particularly in the later years of the mandate period. They were sworn in in a dramatic installation ceremony. It would be by candlelight. There would be a pistol on the table. You would put your hand on a Tanakh, and you would take the oath of the Haganah. And the oath of the Haganah is nice and long, so I chose not to replicate it for us tonight. But it's what you would expect. You know, I will be loyal to the Jewish community and my first priority, and to my comrades in arms, and so what have you, what have you. The Haganah began creating underground cellars on various kibbutzim. And in fact, if you go to Israel today, I think it's called Machon Ayalon, the Ayalon Institute, which is on a kibbutz south. Yeah, I was going to say southeast of Tel Aviv. Yeah,
it was like all the times I've been to Israel. Yeah, it's one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
It's very cool.
So fascinating.
This is underground.
Yeah, you move the big washing machines, and you go downstairs, and it's a bullet factory. Yeah,
and they made the bullets for the 48 war. And what happened was the last part of putting the gunpowder in the bullet was only done by the women, because they felt that they were the mothers and they had their children, and they would be more careful because they didn't want to blow themselves up so that they wouldn't, you know, have kids that were orphans then.
Well, and I was told a story.
If you've never been there, it's so fascinating.
There is a YouTube on that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that.
And there was a movie on that, too.
And what happened there was that the people on the kibbutz didn't know about this.
Right.
So they piped, you know, the air and the smoke, and they went far away so that people didn't know about it. And what they did was they would be underground all day long. So they had these, like, suntan kind of things so that when they would come out, they would look like
I don't remember that.
Also. Really good.
And I was told a wonderful story when I was there that the British would periodically raid a kibbutz to see if anything was going on there. So they would come up to the kibbutz and they would give them warm beer. And the British soldiers said, "Why don't you get us cold beer? You know, don't we deserve cold beer?" And they said, "Well, if you call in advance and let us know when you're coming, you know, we'll be able to put the beer in the icebox." So they called in advance and they were able to warn everybody. So anyway, there was a tremendous amount of creativity that goes into the building of the state. And that's really the fascinating thing that we come across, is that it just keeps going and going and going. I'm going to move ahead to the Haganah was an illegal force. That's important to point out. The British did not want armed militias roaming the country for obvious reasons. However, they did cooperate with the Haganah in 36 to 39 for the Arab Revolt. And we're going to talk more about that next week, so it's not just mythically off into the future, when we deal with the mandate period. Because that's principally what we're going to talk about next week. The Haganah was involved in the first political assassination in Israel. Unfortunately, it wouldn't be the last, as we saw with Yitzhak Rabin in 1995, but this was the first one. There's a guy named, I'm going to spell his name, Jacob is the standard spelling, and then Israel is the standard spelling, and then the next part of the name is small d and e, d, and then a space, and then Han, H-A-A-N. Jacob Israel de Haan. He was a Dutch poet, journalist, and an author. He's a very interesting figure, to say the least. Around 1910, he developed an interest in Judaism and Zionism. This was a result of his trying to get Jews freed from Russian jails. He went to Russia, he appealed, he stayed there for about 2 years. He saw how horrible conditions were for Jews in that country. He was not successful in helping get the Jews out of jail. He was a poet, he was a Luftmann in some regards, so he thought he could get them free. And he became deeply aware of the depth of the anti-Semitism in the country. Eventually, by 1919, he emigrated to Palestine. In a letter to Chaim Weizmann, because you had to appeal to the Jewish agency to get one of the slots to make Aliyah, to move to Palestine, he wrote that he was, quote, anxious to work at rebuilding land, people, and language, end quote. He was also very arrogant. He wrote, "I am not leaving Holland to improve my condition. Neither materially nor intellectually will life in Palestine be equal to my life here. I am one of the best poets of my generation, and the only important Jewish national poet Holland has ever had. It's difficult to give up all this. So he was a nice, humble man. He arrives in Israel as a fanatical Zionist. There's a secret report about him that's filed in the yeshuv. They kept tabs of all the newcomers to see what they could do. They overheard him making some racist anti-Arab remarks at a party shortly after he got there. But in Palestine, a funny thing happened to him. He got interested in religion. Wouldn't be the last one to have that happen to, but hopefully the last one that all this was going to happen to. He became angered when he saw the Zionists' refusal, what he saw was refusal, to cooperate with the Arabs. He aligned himself first with the religious Zionists, the Mizrahi movement. Those are the knit kippah guys that we hear of today. David, and you're wearing a knit kippah over there. Actually, I'm wearing one, too. What? You're Mizrahi. You guys are Mizrahi. You're Eastern. Then he met a guy named Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who was a leader of the Haredi community. Sonnenfeld hated the Zionists because they were violating God's law. And he was the leader of the Haredi community in Jerusalem. Dihan was enamored by the Haredi sense of commitment to what we call the three-legged soul of Judaism, God, Torah, and Israel, Israel meaning the people of Israel, at least the way they understand it and define it. Well, Dihan became the spokesman for this community, right? There were a lot of British journalists going around. There were various British officers to talk to and British officials. Underlying all this, which is fascinating to me, and a theme that comes out in his poems, yet he doesn't lose his position in the Haredi community, is that he's openly homosexual. So, go figure. You have a Dutch poet who becomes a Haredi guy who is gay and writing about it openly. He stayed trusted in the religious community. And I'm amazed at how. I haven't read that much about him. I'm thinking about reading one of the few books I saw on him in complete. Then he crosses the line for the Zionists. He starts to negotiate with the Arabs. And one of the things that he says to the Arabs is, look, how about if, you know, we're going to repudiate immigration and we're going to repudiate the Balfour Declaration if you basically let us live here in peace. We're not going to call this a national Jewish home anymore. They, of course, like this. They strike up a relationship. They start talking. So there's this tension going on between the Haredim and the secular Zionists. The Haredim actually set up their branch of Agudat Yisrael, or Aguda Israel, like the big building on Park Heights Avenue, the big white building, Aguda Israel is the name of that synagogue. It's a Haredi group that's anti-Zionist, and they set up a group like that so that they can have a vehicle to have a relationship with the mandate authorities with. Dehan is named the foreign minister of the Haredi community. He speaks to the British about the tyranny of the Zionist movement. Word about this gets out because British journalists eat it up. British journalists are finding a great story in this guy. Zionist leaders are increasingly concerned, so they decide to do something about it. Dehan is assassinated on June 30th, 1924, in Jerusalem by members of the Haganah. There's no question about that now. We know that because in 1985, a guy named Avraham Tichomi, who died in 1990, said, "I've done what the Haganah decided had to be done, and nothing was done without the order of Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who would go on to become president of Israel. I have no regrets because he wanted to destroy our whole idea of Zionism." So everything isn't rosy in the land of socialism and creating the new Jew. There's still tension. And remember, there was tension back in 1881 when the first immigrants started coming in. We talked about the Biluim with the Haredi community, or the ultra-Orthodox community. Any questions? June 30th, 24. And this is when immigrants are coming in. I mean, there's a real Jewish community that's being built. Now, Tel Aviv is almost 15 years old at this point and going great guns. Excuse the pun. All right, speaking of that, one great happening is the founding of Tel Aviv. And this is my favorite part of Zionist history. Whoop. Not that one. Not that one. Welcome to the beginning of Tel Aviv. 66 people standing on a beach finding out where their house is going to be. I remember in 1983, the first time I was in Tel Aviv, north of the city where there were sand dunes. You don't see them anymore. But Tel Aviv was built on the beach, literally. And it's hard to imagine now, but that's what it looked like. It's a very famous picture, and I am just enthralled by that picture. I can't believe that in such a short period of time, a major metropolis was built. I mean, France was what, you know, 1400s or something like that? And Paris, something like that? I mean, it took a long time to build those cities. You know, Tel Aviv just got over its 100th birthday. People have lived longer than that city has been around. Yeah?
It's laid out in the shape of a menorah.
Yeah, yeah.
We went on an architecture tour, and it is really fascinating. That's why it's kind of strange when you're walking.
Oh, the streets are horrible. The intersections
really
are horrible.
It really is laid out in the shape of a menorah.
As a real estate person, it is one of the most difficult cities to navigate. And right. Jerusalem is too. I think the entire Middle East is just nothing but curves. Nothing comes at right angle. New York is the perfect grid.
Right.
Tel Aviv
right.
is a perfect balagan.
Yeah, Tel Aviv, everything's intersecting everything at a bad
it's
angle.
It's all symbolic. It didn't make sense to
me. Right.
It's like roads going everywhere. It's crazy.
All right, let's talk about Tel Aviv. Originally, it had the name Ahuzat Bait, which is A-H-U-Z-A-T and then B-A-Y-T, which really means the grasping of the home or homestead. Lachez is to grasp. Tel Aviv is the Hebrew translation of Altanuulan by Theodor Herzl. It was by Nachum Sokolov. When it was printed in Hebrew, he called it Tel Aviv. So that was the city that they envisioned. Back in 1906, a group of people in Jaffa came together and said, you know, Jaffa's getting a little crowded here, and it's primarily Arab anyway. We need a Jewish suburb. It wasn't meant to be a new city. It was meant to be a suburb to Jaffa. So their goal was, quote, to form a Hebrew urban center in a healthy environment planned according to the rules of modern hygiene, which is a good thing for the Middle East. So they purchased 60 plots of land. A Dutch citizen registered them in his name so that he would be protected as a Dutchman. The Turks couldn't prevent it. So then the picture you see there takes place on April 1909. 66 families got together, and there was a lottery in which they found out which plot of land they were going to get. And this is, I love this. This guy named Akiva Arya Weiss collected 120 seashells on the beach. Half were white and half were gray. Members' names were written on the white shells, plot numbers on the gray shells. A boy drew the names from one box of shells, and a girl drew the plot numbers from the second. That's the founding of Tel Aviv. 1 year later, these streets were done. Herzl Street, some of which you might have been on, Echad Ha'am Street, which he was actually going to live on, Yehuda Lilienbaum, and Rothschild Streets. Water was installed, 66 houses were built. Next came the high school, the Herzliya High School, which is still there. By 1914, they were on 247 acres. By 1923, there were 16,000 Jews there. By 1926, there were 40,000 Jews there. Tel Aviv grew really quickly. And, you know, I married a woman whose family is Israeli, and the first time I was in Israel with her visiting them, I said to my new brother-in-law, oh, those are big cranes over there. What are they building? And he goes, building, building, building. All they do here is build. And he's absolutely correct. All they do is build, build, build. You can go back to Israel 5 years later and think it's a radically different place.
That's the National Board of Israel.
Yeah.
The crane.
Yeah. Exactly. All right. Did that film ever come up? Okay. Not a problem.
I guess try it again.
That's all right. No, don't waste time. We're running out of time anyway. I don't need it. Let me talk a little bit about an outstanding personality of Tel Aviv, Mayor Dizengoff. Some of you have been on Dizengoff Street. Well, Dizengoff Street, like everything in Israel, is named for somebody. I was once in a bookstore, in a Stamatsky's bookstore in Israel, and there was a book called The Streets of Israel, and it was about all the people that the streets are named after, because in almost every city there's a Nordau Street and a Herzl Street and a, you know, whatever street at this point. All right. Mayor Dizengoff was a really interesting guy. He was born in 1861, so he's a little older than Ben-Gurion. He grew up in Kishinev, which we know about from the pogroms. He actually served in 1882 in the Imperial Russian Army. He met and married Zina Brenner when he was afterwards he came back to Kishinev. Then they went to Odessa. He got involved in the Revolutionary Underground. In 1885, he was arrested, and he served a brief time in the Russian jails, which I can't imagine was any fun whatsoever. He, too, became active with Chovei Tzion. Remember, Chovei Tzion was the only game in town, if you were interested in Zionism at that point. 1880, he went to study in Paris. He studied chemical engineering. No less than Baron Rothschild took a liking to him and said to him, "Why don't you go to Palestine and open up a glass factory for me and employ people there?" Dizengoff said, "Okay, sounds good, I'll do that." He went there, it didn't take. He came back to Europe. But in 1905, spurred on by his Zionist beliefs, he went back to Palestine, and he established the company that bought the land from the Arabs that became Tel Aviv. So in 1911, he becomes head of Tel Aviv town planning. In 1922, when Tel Aviv is recognized as a city, he becomes the mayor of Tel Aviv. He served in that position until his death in 1936, with the exception of 3 years in the 1920s. His life as mayor was a busy one. And let me see, I think I have a good picture of him. Let's see, and I have a couple pictures of Tel Aviv. This is his house, which also served as the city council headquarters at Mayor Dizengoff's house. And that was around 1920. And this is Tel Aviv. I love this picture. In the 1920s, you can see how quickly it's changed from 1909 standing on the beach. And this is Tel Aviv 11 years later. It's quite an accomplishment, to say the least. And there's Mr. Dizengoff, sitting at his desk. When he wasn't at his desk, by the way, he was riding around town on his horse. And if you go to Israel today, sometimes if you go to what's called Independence Hall now, which used to be his house, there's a statue of him outside there riding on his horse. I can't remember his horse's name, but he would famously ride his horse in front of the Purim parade, the Adlo Yada.
Is that where the independence was proclaimed?
Yes.
Rothschild Street.
Is it Rothschild Street?
Yeah, it's right across from it.
But at one point, that was Dizengoff's house. But they obviously they refitted it.
That
they
has a wide median in it.
Yeah. That's where they had the protests.
Right.
Social protests.
Let's see. Where were we? He went on daily inspections of the city works, as I said, often on his horse. He paid a lot of attention to entertainment. He felt that was very important. He started a Mizrahi fair, an Eastern fair. He was very big. The Tel Aviv Purim Carnival was and is famous in Israel for being the most colorful one. I've never seen it, but if you go on YouTube, as I did, you'll find all types of different displays of it on there. After his wife's death, he donated the house to the city, his original house to the city as an art museum. It became the Tel Aviv Museum of Art, and that building is now Independence Hall. 1936, really probably his lasting thing that he did for Tel Aviv, is when the Arabs started revolting in the Arab Revolt of 36-39. Jews could no longer use the port at Jaffa, so he persuaded the British to create a port at Tel Aviv. And that is how the port of Tel Aviv came into being. Originally, everything was just to the south there. Ironically, today, Jaffa is now part of Tel Aviv again. The city, if you look on the map, says Tel Aviv Jaffa, or Tel Aviv Jaffa. All right, how are we doing? Okay. All right, now I've mentioned him a few times. We turn to Yitzhak Ben Tzvi. Yitzhak Ben Tzvi is another person that you don't hear much about these days, but he is definitely worthy of our time. Let me just see something. You know what? I'm going to maybe come back to Ben Tzvi. If not, I might talk about him next week. I want to turn to change gears and turn to a controversial poet, a guy named Uri Tzvi Greenberg. Anybody ever heard of him? Ever hear him? Really, really interesting character. Here's what the YIVO Encyclopedia of Jews in Eastern Europe had to say about him. And let's see if I have that for you to follow along. Oh, there's a picture of him. That's a typical klatch in Warsaw. Let's see if I have the... There we go. Let's see if I can get them in there. Not quite. All right. This is a wonderful description of an artist with a purpose. As a poet, Greenberg faced heroic tasks, which he approached with courage, integrity, and an upsurge of expressive diction of a symphonic richness that often overwhelmed the readers. He had to put together and unify at least 5 different elements that did not necessarily dovetail: personal memory and ideological insight into the essence of his mission as a political persona, a mystical, essentially Kabbalistic view of nature and of the process of life as its core, a new metaphysics of death and dying, and a new poetics that had to find a synthesis between the poet's early burgeoning modernism and his later neo-traditionalism. Now, the reason why they can say all that in fancy words about him is he had a tremendous volume of work that he put out. But let me give you, as always, a little bio information on him. He lived a long life, 1896 to 1981. He was a Hebrew Yiddish poet and essayist. He was also a leader in revisionist Zionism. Periodically I've mentioned revisionist Zionism, and we're going to do more on it, but we haven't really looked at any of their figures yet. He was also a member of the first Knesset. He was from a small Galician village. He came from religious Hasidic roots, unlike many of his generation. He was educated in a cheder. He was drafted by the Austro-Hungarian army in 1915, so he saw the horrors of World War I, and they made a tremendous impact on him. In fact, the image that haunted him the most was of soldiers lying on barbed wire dead, and that image would come up in his writings, in his poetry, periodically. He also said he saw, quote, an indifferent God incorporated in dead and mutilated flesh. So clearly he was no longer going to be religious. After the war, he and his family got caught in one of the pogroms of Polish soldiers coming home from the war. Somehow they survived. He eventually would go to Warsaw, where he would mix, as we see here in this photo, with some of the leading poets of the era. And Warsaw was a very cosmopolitan city at that point, as we can tell from the picture. However, in 1923, he had to flee Poland. He had insulted Jesus in some of his poetry, and the Polish censor was coming after him to have him jailed. He fled to Berlin and did a little working there, and eventually he made his way to Palestine, also in 1923, as a committed, what he called, a poet pioneer. Interestingly, he wrote for Devar, which was the labor newspaper, or one of the labor newspapers. The Palestine press was very rich in terms of options. It really was wonderful at that point. He often wrote about what was in store for the Jews of Europe. He kept predicting what was going to be an upcoming tragedy. This is back in 1923. His works frequently refer to traditional sources as proof texts. So he might no longer want to be religious, but that's part of his education, and he doesn't ignore that. He became more radicalized. He strongly opposed the Zionist organization for not pushing for a state now and for cooperating with the British. He felt that that was inappropriate. That wasn't the goal, because the clouds were gathering. The sole goal, he said, was the state. And he began writing a tremendous amount of poetry. And he met critical acclaim. Then he turned to political poetry, and he started making some enemies. He became a revisionist. He founded a group called Brita Bironiaim. Bironiaim. 1930, he set that up. That means a strongman alliance. So this is, remember Max Nordau, the muscular Jews, the muscle Jews? So he's a modern, successor to that concept. This is a direct out of direct frustration to what he considers to be the Haganah's lack of effectiveness in the 29 riots. He's influenced by the fascism in Italy. He wants to emulate what Mussolini's thugs are doing there, because they're getting society moving. He started being engaged in an activist policy of betraying the British. He and some others would go and they would blow a shofar at the Western Wall. It was against the law to blow a shofar at the Western Wall. It changed the status quo. It enraged the Arabs. The British didn't want you to do it. They would tear down the Nazi flags at the German consulates in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. The German government was set up there, as they had always been, and the Nazis came to power, and they put up, believe it or not, Nazi flags flying in Israel, or the state, the land of Israel. The beginning of World War II, he was actually in Poland doing some recruiting for Jabotinsky. No, Jabotinsky was Yeah, Jabotinsky was still alive. He was 39. He was doing some recruiting for Jabotinsky, and he somehow made his way back to Israel. When the war started, however, he stopped writing poetry. A lot of people, he never talked about why, but a lot of people think this was because his family was left behind and he was afraid that he would be endangering them. But after the war, he started up again, and he was really acknowledged as one of the most preeminent commentators on what happened to the Jewish people for the rest of his life. He would go on to become right-wing in every sense of the word. When the Western Wall was taken in 67, he was one of the people that immediately got behind what's called the Greater Land of Israel movement and the need to promote Jewish settlement throughout the Land of Israel and to never give anything back. He said that the word Holocaust wasn't strong enough for what happened. The word is really Korban. Anybody know that word?
Sacrifice.
It's not sacrifice, it's destruction. But it's a specific destruction. It's the destruction of the temple. So he felt that that's what happened because the Jewish people, in his view, were the temple. He was continued to write in Haaretz, a very liberal newspaper then as well as now. You know, many newspapers want to have somebody from a different perspective writing in there. And now his columns were very popular, but he didn't write articles. He just wrote poetry. And unfortunately, today in Israel and in this country too, you don't really have poetry in newspapers anymore. But he did it until his death. So that was a pretty significant thing, and he was a pretty significant person. All right. How much time do we have? My watch is kind of messed up.
I'm going to call it.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
The
Oh, I know what he's going to say.